Hello, this is Josh Henkin from SandbagFitnessSystems.com, and today I have a very special guest, someone that I've known and respected for quite some time, Mr. Steve Maxwell. Steve, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Josh. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I really appreciate it. And, you know, we've been fortunate enough to have some really great coaches being interviewed, and one thing I really respected about you is that you've been doing this quite some time, and for those of you that aren't familiar with you and your work, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your experience, and what you've been up to?
Well, start way back in the early 70s. I actually got my first part-time job in the fitness industry in 1971 at Huff & Puff Gym.
Great name.
And it was the first Nautilus gym in Pennsylvania at that time, and probably one of a handful of Nautilus gyms on the East Coast. That was back when Arthur Jones was making his big inroads with his newfangled Nautilus equipment. Prior to that time, I had been involved with Olympic weightlifting. Growing up in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, we were right next to York, and my dad used to take me down there as a youngster, to watch the Olympic lifters work out. And, of course, the great John Grimmick was also the editor of one of the magazines from York, and he was down there. And it was just a great environment to cut my teeth and grow up in. And once I read about Jones and his high-intensity training and these new machines, of course, I was quite intrigued and got my first job. So that goes back there pretty far. That's, you know, more than 36 years, I guess. And
so you've had a little bit of experience.
A little bit of experience, and a lot of it with the high-intensity crowd in the beginning. But as time went on, I began to realize that there was a lot. But the high-intensity training protocols, although they were very result-producing, I mean, there's plenty of guys who made great progress, it wasn't giving me quite what I wanted. I was always searching, seeking. One of my primary concerns was always my grappling career, both wrestling, jiu-jitsu, and so forth. And I felt that there was a better way to condition myself. And I was looking for that. And I've tried many different systems, many different exercise philosophies, and so forth. And I finally settled with some of the bodyweight conditioning programs I'm doing now, as well as the Russian kettlebell system. I felt that those two were probably the biggest bang for the buck when it comes to conditioning athletes, particularly combat athletes.
And now, I know, Steve, not to interrupt you, but, you know, that's a big thing that a lot of people are into right now. But, you know, a lot of people get into the idea that you can't get really strong doing bodyweight stuff and kettlebells. I mean, obviously, you work with a diverse population. Well, what's been your experience?
Well, you know, it just depends how you define strength. You know, anyone that thinks that you can't get strong doing bodyweight exercise, all they have to do is just get on the mat with me or my son or any number of guys I've trained, and you'll see how strong a guy can get. You know, it just depends how you define strength. Is it going to make you better at, you know, pressing a heavy barbell over your head or doing powerlifting? No. But by the same token, I've seen many guys that were pretty decent at powerlifting, Olympic lifting, and so forth, and they can't do a one-arm push-up. They can't do a one-leg pistol. They don't have the mobility or the strength. You see, it just all depends on what we're talking about here. But, you know, I always like to point to gymnasts who, pound for pound, are some of the strongest guys around. I've never seen a gymnast with a poor upper body. And frequently, these guys exhibit world-class strength in their ability to, you know, to perform iron crosses and Maltese crosses and, you know, muscle ups and so forth and so on. And, you know, they use bodyweight exercise. That's just one example, of course. But, wrestlers world over, grapplers, you know, the tradition was the majority of the work was done with bodyweight exercise, and it works very well.
Well, and, you know, I have to interrupt what you're talking about earlier with the history and your process of going through these things, and you said something interesting that those two you know, body weights and kettlebells you found to be such the biggest bang for your buck. What do you find that people get out of training that way? I mean, what is it? What type of results do you usually see?
Well, one of the things I was always interested in was metabolic conditioning. And what I mean by metabolic conditioning, in combat sports in particular, and of course that's always been my emphasis, but I'd like to point out to people listening to this that even just for regular fitness training, you know, you don't have to necessarily be a jiu-jitsu fighter or a wrestler or a grappler to benefit training like one. Even just regular Joes that, you know, are stuck at, you know, behind the desk all day can benefit from training the same way that elite athletes do. And that's that's an important point. But this metabolic conditioning where you are working really hard at a very high level of, much more strength while simultaneously involving the cardio system, that very closely duplicates the stresses of going out there in the mat, of the actual fighting. And I mean, sometimes you feel worse than you did if you did have a real fight. You really do. I mean, and the thing I like, you're getting the strength, endurance, cardio, conditioning. You know, you're learning to learn to buffer the high level of lactic acid you produce, and you get that mental toughness. And a lot of the kettlebell and bodyweight movements I use put the body in all different bendy, twisty positions. You know, there's a thing in jiu-jitsu, you should learn to put yourself there because someone's going to put you there whether you want them to or not.
Well said.
And, you know, so I use a lot of mobility drills in with the kettlebell so that you are getting a lot of mobility, you're getting a lot of full-range movement, you're getting in a lot of awkward positions that you're going to find yourself in anyway. So it's just a system of strengthening the body from head to toe. You don't need separate stretching. You don't need a separate running program. You don't need a separate strength program. You're getting it all at once because most people don't have enough time to do all those things. You're lucky to get the average guy into the gym at all. But if you can give him a workout system that's going to strengthen his heart, it's going to make his, increase bone density, tendon strength, increase the range of motion in his joints, make him stronger. Well, you know, people are willing to pay for that, and that's what I do, and that's what they pay me for.
That's two things that I respect you greatly about. Is one is that before I really interrupt you, you owned your own studio for quite a long time and have worked with, you know, from the very deconditioned to world champion athletes. So you can really speak about, you know, how to progress and how to work people into these systems. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how does someone begin doing such a program, because I think that's where people get stuck, is where to even start.
Well, it just, once again, if a person has zero experience and let's say they're towards middle age, they need to get down to a gym and they need to hire a good trainer like yourself and myself, someone that really knows what they're doing, and, just learn the techniques. It's pretty hard to learn on your own. Even though I'm in the business of selling DVDs as well as personal services, I realize that for many people it's hard to learn from a DVD. There's nothing like hands-on training, either a workshop, a seminar, going to a guy that really knows what he's doing and get fine-tuned. And then if the particular person is pretty motivated, well, then, of course, they can start working out on their own, no problem. But there are many people that just can't get themselves motivated, and they just need constant supervision. So I guess it's a matter of knowing yourself, really. I mean, some people should always be supervised, and then some people can, once they learn the techniques, go off and practice on their own. But one of the cool things about the kettlebell system and a lot of the body weight stuff, you don't need a lot of apparatus. You don't need to spend thousands and thousands of dollars in workout equipment. It's pretty basic, really. And you can pretty much do it anytime, any place, anywhere.
And that's, I think, a great concern for a lot of people because, we live in an era of everyone's in a rush. Everyone's pressed for time and wants results. And, you know, the other thing that, you know, for people that haven't seen you or got to experience, you know, what you teach is, you know, you're in phenomenal shape yourself. So you obviously practice what you preach and, you know, hopefully not embarrassing, but you're 55 now?
I'll be 56 in December.
Okay, and you know, I attended your workshop up in Vegas, and I swear you could kick my ass and probably about everyone else's ass there. And, you know, that was very enlightening and impressive at the same time. So, you know, do you have any thoughts about anti-aging? I know that's a big term. You know, people, I think, you know, get to a certain age and they almost want to give up on their fitness. You know, I hear clients all the time just go, well, that's a fact of just being old. You know, what are your thoughts, and do you have any, you know, ideas with that?
Well, a lot of what we consider normal aging is just a belief system. A belief system meaning that if you believe something, it's very real for you. If you don't believe it, it's not real. For example, I know some people that have a vested interest in being sick all the time. They believe in sickness, and they attract it. It's almost like you are what you believe. And aging is the same thing. One of my heroes, of course, has always been Jack LaLanne. The guy's in his 90s, still doing one-arm push-ups, and he's just this dynamic person. Jack doesn't believe in aging. He doesn't even believe in celebrating birthdays. And he is just like this amazing guy, right? Or is he normal and everybody else could be like that if they would just share the same belief system? See, the way I think Jack is probably what everybody could be if they would do what Jack does, if they were willing to put the time in and work out and eat right and do all the things that you need to do to keep your youth and your vitality. The problem is most people aren't willing to do that. And then they have this, you know, vested belief in being older. It's almost like an excuse, really, you know, claiming that, oh, well, I'm getting older now. It's real easy to fall back in that because you're just not willing to do what you need to do to stay young and supple and strong and fit. So I'm thinking that what we consider normal aging is abnormal. That normal aging is more along the lines of a Jack LaLanne. There's plenty of other athletes out there, too. You know, like Clarence Bass, he's a pretty amazing guy for his age.
Absolutely.
My mentor, Dr. Gregory Ellis, you know, he's in his 60s, and he looks like a young Adonis. You know, there's guys out there that are doing it. What separates them from others, you know? Of course, obviously, good genetics plays a role, but it's so much more than that. So much more than that. It's the whole lifestyle. And it's a matter of concentrating on it, not just concentrating on your career or your job or making the money, because that stuff, you know, I mean, it's everyone likes to have money. But if you spend all your energy and all your time getting it, you're never going to have the health to enjoy it. Can't tell you how many guys I've seen in their late 40s, early 50s, with their big guts and their big butts and they're fat and they're sluggish and they can't get it up anymore. And it's like, what was it all about? You know, they would give easily all that money up if they could, you know, be young and strong and the truth of the matter is, Josh, they can't. You just got to be willing to do it, man. You just got to be willing to do what is necessary. And my system of exercise that I've created is based on, like, a lot of different Eastern European and Asian exercise system. I kind of took the best of all of these to create the Maxxercise system. And I think it's, like, one of the best exercise anti-aging systems in the world, along with, you know, a strict diet. And when I go to these seminars and so forth, I do like to show off a bit in that I want people to see that I'm not like one of these test, you know, like armchair quarterbacks that can talk the talk but not walk the walk. I think that if you're going to espouse a system, then you better be a damn good example, and you better be able to put up or shut up. So I've always prided myself in keeping myself in pretty good shape, and I work out like an animal, you know? And that's the secret. You just can't stop. You know, like Jack Lane said, violent, vigorous exercise just about every day. And for the guys that have stopped and want to get back into the game, well, you know, you got to start real slow and build yourself back up, but it is possible. I have seen guys that, you know, got themselves in pretty, you know, pretty bad shape, but I've seen plenty of guys, you know, get back in top shape. It just takes a lot of patience and a lot of work. Just depends what your priorities are, what your value system is, really.
And that's important because, I mean, it's not easy. It's not, you know, no matter what people like to believe, it's never going to be easy. There's no magic pill. But your system is so intriguing because I think it's so different than a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of people have integrated, you know, one component, you know, whether it be mobility or kettlebells or body weight, but you actually encompass it all. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your system specifically, you know, what made you create it, how it's different, and, you know, how people can find out learning a little bit more about it.
Well, one of the things that bothered me a lot was this big dependence on performance-enhancing drugs. And the only source of information for most young guys, you know, from the 60s on, were the muscle magazines and the newsstand. And in those muscle magazines, they would show these, you know, big muscular guys, and they would do these amazing routines. Some of these routines were like some real serious marathon routines. And, you know, later on, you know, you would see athletes performing similar type of routines, both football players and now with the MMA phenomenon. And then, you know, later you learn that, well, these guys are all using drugs. So how can you trust that the guy really knows how to diet and how to eat and how to work out without the drugs? What if you're a guy that wants to go 100% natural and you don't want to risk your health taking performance-enhancing drugs? I read about one bodybuilder, for example, that was this lean-cut guy, and the guy was eating a whole ice cream cake every single night.
Wow.
He's a well-known competitor. But because he was taking a thyroid medication, right? He could eat, you know, he could eat this amount of sugar and all this junk and have this ripped, shredded physique because he was taking all these synthetic hormones. Well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to play that game. You know, I'd like to go natural. So I realized that I had to go back in history prior to 1950 and look at the systems that had produced the mighty men of old. What were some of those systems? Well, the supermen of India, the Hindu wrestling system, they produced some of the greatest wrestlers ever in history. At the turn of the century, there was a guy that went around the European circuit and kicked everybody's butt. And he followed the ancient system of exercise that the Hindu wrestlers did. Then there was a system called the Zulkarnain. It was a system that the Iranian wrestlers use even to this day. And every year after year, people from that area of the world, all those little Stan republics, they go in there in judo and wrestling and just kicking everyone's butt. What are they doing? Well, they've been doing it for 2,000 years. And if you want to go and study it, you can. You can find out these things. It's, you know, the information's out there, but it takes a little research. And I did that. There was a fellow by the name of Georgie Bear that created the natural movement method of exercise. Almost no one's ever heard of this guy. No one paid attention to him, especially the French. But I'll tell you who did pay attention to him. It was the Nazis. And, you know, think what you will about the horror of what they did. They produced quite a superior fighting man. And had they played the cards right, we might always be speaking German. Thank God it didn't happen. But the SS and the some of the elite fighting groups used the Iber method. That method's out there. You can find it. There was a guy here in the States, Dr. Thomas Kirk Curitan, Professor Emeritus from Springfield, Mass. He created this amazing strength endurance system using just body weight. So I went to all these different guys. These are just, you know, the tip of the iceberg. I looked at tons and tons of material from all over the place. I looked at the Eastern European method. I looked at some of the things that the ancient Cossacks were doing, some of the things the Mongolians were doing, some of the things that the Japanese martial artists were doing, some of the things the Shaolin monks were doing. And I took bits and pieces from all these different programs and put them together, parts that I really liked, parts that I thought were valuable, and then discarded things that I thought were foolish, and created my max exercise system. And I know that these techniques work because of the I can look in history and see what was produced. I mean, this is the way the warriors of old worked out. The interesting thing, Josh, a lot of these systems from all these diverse parts of the world, there's a lot of similarities. I mean, people are pretty smart, you know. There's only so many ways to hammer a nail. And it's amazing how, like, from all these different diverse parts of the world, people came to many of the same conclusions. Many of the same conclusions. There's like a body rolling joint mobility type exercise from Eastern Europe. And the Gracie family, along with this guy, Professor Vera Romano, produced the Gymnastica Naturale. It's almost the same damn thing, you know? Here's this guy
right.
In South America, came up with almost a similar system to, like, what a lot of the Eastern European people were doing. I find that kind of stuff fascinating. But anyway, I've looked at all these different things. I've put them together in different programs. Of course, I'm forever evolving, changing, trying, experimenting on myself and others. When people see that gleam in my eye, they run the other way sometimes. Cause they,
I know that feeling.
They know that, uh-oh, Steve got something up his sleeve, man. He's going to try something new. I better get out of here. And usually it's pretty hard. Because one thing I did find that it usually takes some pretty hard work to produce any kind of worthwhile permanent result.
So what were some of the commonalities you found amongst these systems? You know, what were some of the principles that you sort of said, aha, to?
Well, the breath, breathing. You know, I was never taught to breathe until I started looking at some of the yogic systems, and some of these Asian systems. They put a lot of emphasis on breath and breath control, as well as the Eastern European exercise system. So that was interesting, how the breath becomes all important. Whether you call it chi or pranayama or, you know, whatever, the use of and manipulation of the breath cycle and breathing and paying attention to it was something I found pretty interesting. The idea of just natural cycles in the program. Seems like everyone the world over realizes that you can't go full throttle all the time, and there's ways that you can cycle the training. The idea of using active recovery I found to be pretty common in almost every system that I looked at. Whereas on your rest days, you just don't sit around and rest, but you use light to mild activity as a form of recovery. That, you know, doing something on a more mild level on the off days is much better than just not doing anything at all. I mean, these are just some little ideas. It seems like, you know, there's some of the more common things. And, of course, a lot of the specific exercises themselves, too. It was like, mm-hmm. Wow. Certain exercises and so forth you would see in many, many different systems.
Well, and speaking of which, you know, I think joint mobility has gotten to be quite popular as of the last few years. And I know you have a program, and I often am asked about the differences between different programs. You know, what are your thoughts? You know, what made you create your system? And what is, more importantly, how does joint mobility differ from just stretching?
Well, stretching pretty much depends on gravity. And the way most people stretch, it's fairly static and non-moving. And a lot of people feel, there's plenty of experts in the field that feel that it's probably not that important, that your ability to move into full range voluntarily is way more important. And that, you know, the difference between mobility and I guess static stretching is there's a strength factor and there's a movement factor. So that rather than just sitting there and letting gravity do the work and, you know, holding a certain static position for time, you're moving it in and out using strength. And that becomes important in sports because, you know, when you, let's say, for example, you take a guy, you know, all of a sudden someone hits a ground ball and he has to spring into action and make a diving catch or whatever. You know, that takes a lot of mobility and so forth. And that's something that you don't get, the ability to move through all these different ranges of motion when you're just doing static stretching. Give a perfect example. I had a guy that pro baseball player that had been training pretty much the standard style weight training, more or less powerlifting style. And he claimed he got himself really strong on the basic lifts, the deadlifts, the squats, the bench. Now, the guy was doing some pretty terrific weights and had gained 15 pounds or so, and claimed he was stronger than he'd ever been in his life and bigger and more muscular. He had also, at the same time, been doing some static, you know, typical static stretching for the hamstrings and the quads and the hip flexors and such. The very first game of the regular season, he went down for a ground ball and completely threw his back out. You see, the guy did have flexibility, and he certainly had strength, but he didn't have the ability to move. He didn't have the ability to move suddenly into a kind of weird, you know, angular position, and immediately his muscles just seized up. You know, he got a little stress reflex going there, and he tore something, and he was messed up for pretty much the full season, man, and no one was more disappointed than him. So I put him on a mobility program, and we didn't do any heavy lifting at all. We did primarily body weight movements. And in some cases, the resistance is extremely great. So it's not like he wasn't getting a lot of resistance for his muscles, but we weren't using heavy external weights to do it. And lots of joint mobility. I got him to lose some of that extra weight, and the guy never felt better than all his life. Better and better and better. Felt like he played better and better. So this is one example of like how mobility training really helped out a pro athlete, pro baseball in this particular case.
Well, and, you know, that's pretty phenomenal. And, you know, you have a whole series on that. So, you know, that's very expensive. So if people are kind of still mystified upon what we're talking about, they can definitely check that out, because you basically go head to toe and everywhere in between in that series, don't you?
I do. And a lot of that was just by necessity, because I had, you know, hurt myself quite a bit, you know, doing the crazy stuff I do. I mean, that's something you kind of accept. When you do a sport like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, your opponent is basically trying to bend, twist, choke, throw, you know, break your limbs, you know, make you, choke you to sleep, you know, as best he can. He's trying to hurt you as much as possible to make you tap out. And, you know, you can't do a sport like that without suffering some consequences, and that's something that you accept in doing it. And I, you know, I had a lot of little tweaks and so forth, and so the joint mobility was like an imperative for me, because I found that many of these exercises were very healing in nature. They would get the range of motion back, they would nourish my joints. You know, when you do these high repetition movement exercises in the mobility series, you're basically washing your joint with synovial fluid and carrying waste products out of there. You know, if you are bound up a little bit, you can get things to release and get this full range of motion. And, of course, that's also a good way to tell whether you need more therapy or not. If, you know, if I spend a couple of weeks doing my mobility drills and the joint or, you know, the area that's injured doesn't respond, that's when I know it's time to go to my Rolfer or my acupuncturist or whatever to get a little extra help.
Well, and you know, when I went through your course, I mean, if you do the program as you lay it out, I mean, it's fatiguing. I mean, it could wipe you out.
It can be a standalone workout, absolutely. And there, like I said, there is a strength component to it. There's no way that a guy could do, you know, Cossack stretches, some of the other type of leg movements that we use, you know, drag and twist and so forth, without getting pretty fatigued in the legs and some of the upper body movements, especially in the advanced series. But then I have a milder series too, which are, you know, like more just like an active recovery. I got a lot of my early stuff from Scott Sonnen, and I really liked a lot of his work. And then I took the Z Health program and looked at what Cobb was doing, and took a lot of what they did and combined it into my own. And then, of course, I studied Nikolai Amosov's joint mobility system and his 1,000 moves to heaven. Looked at some things that some Ukrainian wrestlers were doing that I knew. And then I looked at some very interesting yoga type systems that had a lot to offer as far as mobility and movement. It wasn't your normal type yoga. And basically took parts that I really needed for myself and combined them together in my own mobility system.
And, you know, that's what I was going to hit on is that, you know, you could probably, I mean, that system probably is ideal for an active recovery workout, correct?
It absolutely is. And even sometimes a standalone workout. For example, today I did my four-corner balance drill, and then I did rolling deck squats, and my legs were trashed, totally trashed. I mean, that was really, really hard. Good strength endurance, good cardio, good mobility. My hips felt loose and, you know, really felt great, much different than, let's say, doing like a heavy squat routine or something where you feel really tight. I mean, my body felt really mobile and loose, but yet I've been going through all these very full range movements and exercises and basically taxed every muscle from my toes right up and through my hips. So mobility can be used as like a standalone, and it can be strenuous. So it doesn't necessarily even have to be active recovery. And then there's milder forms of mobility training that one can use. Let's say, for example, I just can't get on the mat. I don't have the energy to do much else, but I want to do something. Well, then there's milder forms. My standing series is just something just to kind of loosen up and get the blood flowing and get the circulation going. A lot of the mobility encompasses elements of Qigong, the Chinese medical exercise, and so forth. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel energized and revived.
Yeah, it's a novel concept, actually. It's supposed to make you feel good, right?
Yeah. That's the idea.
Well, you know, and it's obviously a perfect complement to your kettlebell program. And, you know, for those that are unfamiliar, I mean, you were one of the first people to bring to be active in America and bring kettlebells back to mainstream. Can you talk a little bit about that and your Spartan series and what's motivated you to do that?
Well, I was the first person to have kettlebell classes in the United States. When Pablo Satsolin wrote his first kettlebell article in Milo magazine, I jumped on it. Something about what he described really sung true for me, and the guy was a great writer, and I really enjoyed the article. And I actually called him up. I figured, how many Satsolians can there be in the St. Paul film? And we had a great conversation and collaborated together. And I helped put together the RKC program. A lot of the ideas that are being used to this day in the RKC came from Steve Maxwell. I introduced the Turkish Get-Up to the RKC community. And the windmill exercise, and a lot of these movements were just old-school time movements that people used to do with dumbbells and so forth. But the kettlebell was the perfect tool to do it with. But once they, Dragon Drill was the first manufacturer of the kettlebell. Prior to that time, I actually had homemade kettlebells that a student of mine made in a metal shop. And once they came out, I just maxed out a credit card. and bought like a whole slew of these things. I mean, every size, right up through the 48, and was the first person to actually have kettlebell classes. And I used my students and my customers more or less like guinea pigs, really. And I had a lot of personal training clients that I would just try this and try that and try this exercise and try combinations and mix it with body weight, barbell, and sandbags and rubber bands, everything you could think of, every kind of combination you could think of, and we did this for 9 years. And I mean, hundreds and hundreds of classroom hours that I spent, just like a laboratory scientist trying to put together my system. And I decided to throw my hat in the ring after looking at what's out there, AKC, RKC. I thought, well, you know, it's time for Steve Maxwell to step up because I have more experience than all these guys put together. And I know as much as anybody out there, and that's not, you know, just ego speaking. I mean, it's the God's honest truth. I used to sit up at night thinking stuff up just for my students to do. And, you know, like, being a professional and and being a professional instructor and having my own gym, I mean, it gave me a huge advantage over a lot of these other guys. Most of these other guys were never trainers, and most of them never had their own gym. And, you know, they're out there teaching. I'm thinking, well, heck, man, I need to start doing this thing, man. I love doing it. I love teaching. I love being in front. I love sharing my ideas. I guess I was just a natural born teacher. And it just gives me great pleasure to see people evolve and learn and to share ideas and so forth. And so I started my own Matt Spell kettlebell certification, and it's met with rave reviews. And, you know, at the back of my manual, I created a really nice little manual, and I asked three questions. You know, what did you like about the seminar and the course? What didn't you like? And the most important one, what are you going to tell others? And so far, it's just been overwhelmingly positive. And it's always little things like, oh, not enough meal breaks, or, you know, we went too long without eating, or, you know, probably the negative. But, you know, never anything on course content.
Right.
To satisfy customers. I did one in Europe. I had my first kettlebell cert in Iceland, in Reykjavik, at the Club Mjolnir, which means Thor's Hammer. Kind of cool name, yeah?
Thor's
Hammer for a kettlebell jiu-jitsu place. And graduated 24 instructors in Iceland. And I have certifications now scheduled here at Philadelphia for this next spring. We're going to Hawaii to do a kettlebell certification just outside of Honolulu. I have one scheduled in Europe. The London Kettlebell Club's contacted me. I'll be in Dublin, Ireland. Portland, Oregon, and I'm going to do another one in San Jose. So, and this is all effortless, Josh. I'm not a slick marketer. No one ever accused Steve Maxwell of being a slick businessman. You know, I have no business acumen whatsoever. I never took all those internet marketing courses like, you know, the Decanes and the Sonnens and these guys, you know. I just started making it up as I went, and you know what? People realize when you're a bullshit artist and when you're not. And when it comes from the heart
right.
and care, people know. They know. They sense it. You know? Sure, I want to make money. This is how I feed myself. This is how I pay, you know, support my kids. But it's not why I do it. I do it because it's part of me. It's who I am. It's what I am. I couldn't not do it. I would probably, you know, if tomorrow I won the lottery, and I never had to work again for the rest of my life, I would still do this, Josh. I would. Because this is what gives me joy. This is what I love doing. And so it's about the money, but it's not about the money. Of course, I got to charge for what, you know, fair trade, right? I give the information, and people pay me for it. But it's been really a joy. I've been having a lot of fun with this thing, and people are just calling out of the woodwork. I mean, literally, with very little marketing on my part, people are finding out about it, and they realize, hey, this guy has some knowledge that I'd like to have, and you know, so far it's been effortless.
Well, that's awesome, and that's the biggest compliment is when you don't have to hard sell people on the idea. And, you know, like you said, I mean, with your background and years of working with people, that gives you a lot of leeway, because my colleagues and I always joke about the fact that there's a lot of people out there making a lot of money. They've never worked with a person a day in their life, you know, in that setting or a group class. And so it's good to see people like yourself out there and sharing your knowledge in formats that people can benefit from. And speaking of which, too, you know, you've had so much experience. And, you know, one thing that's always interesting that I've heard you say over and over again is you're not into big, trendy ideas. And actually, you prefer to read stuff you know, I hate to use the word old school, but, you know, the stuff, the material that's what prior to, you have a rule, don't you, that's prior to what year?
1950. Yeah, as I mentioned before, that's, you know, anabolic steroid drugs came in vogue right about the 60s when they started experimenting with these things. Both the U.S. and the Eastern Bloc, you know, I mean, the drugs here in the States were just as good as the ones, if not better than the ones that they used in the Eastern Bloc. Everybody was using them, and people are still using them, and you just can't trust a lot of the modern information. You just don't know when a guy's espousing a workout system or program, and the guy works great. You know, he may be this young, ripped specimen, but you just don't know whether the guy built his system on, you know, through the use of performance-enhancing drugs. Because we, you know, I mean, any program works. Let's face it. Every program works, more or less, as long as it's not, like, something really insane. And anyone can get results from any program at any given time. But some of these programs I look at look pretty insane to me. I mean, just the sheer volume. How do you even have enough time in the day to do all this stuff, you know? And how are these guys doing, you know, this day in and day out and not just, to, you know, totally going into a catabolic state? Well, you gotta assume that they're probably taking performance-enhancing drugs. So that's one reason why I had that rule, you know, prior to 1950. And if you look at, like, what some of these guys were doing, even without so much as a Flintstone vitamin, no supplements, no creatine, nothing, man, just food and good hard work. Some of these guys are actually more amazing than a lot of our modern athletes.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to read a fascinating book sometime, get David Willoughby's The Super Athletes and read some of the things that people were doing. Just amazing, some of the specimens that, you know. I mean, imagine being a Roman legionnaire and doing a forced march of 20 miles while carrying 80 pounds of equipment and then fighting a full-pitched battle for 3 to 6 hours. Imagine.
I don't think we have any elite athletes that could do that nowadays.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, imagine the Spartans, you know, and the regimen that they put themselves through, you know. I mean, these guys were some really amazing guys, but they did it naturally. We know that because they didn't have the drugs back then. You know, oh, they had their herbs and they had, you know, they had their painkillers and they had their hallucinogens and, you know, they, you know, they had a lot of, you know, but still, for the most part, you can pretty much trust what they were doing as being pretty much 100% natural without all the synthetic, you know, performance enhancers out there. That's why I created that little rule for myself.
Well, and it seemed like it influenced you even from a nutritional and lifestyle side, too. Is that accurate?
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, I try to eat pretty much what my ancient ancestors would have eaten pre-agriculturally. I mean, I'll eat some, you know, small amount of vegetables and occasionally some fruit, but, you know, pretty much a protein, fat-based diet that's worked very, very well for me, and I don't see any reason to change it. I maintain a very low percent body fat pretty much year-round, and if I find myself starting to put on a little bit of unwanted body fat, then I'll just get really, really strict for a few days to a few weeks and get it right off, and it's pretty effortless on a low-carb, high-protein, high-fat diet.
That's anyone who's seen the pictures on your website can attest to. You can't really complain about the results that you have with such a lifestyle.
I'm very, very pleased, and it wasn't always that way either. You know, I had mentioned one of my mentors, Dr. Gregory Ellis. He was the guy to give me my first job in the fitness industry back in 1971. And he was the guy that pretty much talked to me about this program. He's a pretty amazing guy. He's a PhD in biochemistry and board certified nutritionist from Temple Medical School, and he had a degree in exercise physiology before he went into the biochemical nutrition game. And he practices alternative medicine in just outside of Philadelphia, Glen Mills, PA. And he was the one that really turned my head around and got me off of what I was actually on a vegetarian regimen at the time, and got me to start eating animal proteins and animal foods again, and I can't tell you how much better I felt and how much stronger and how much leaner I got. It was just like night and day.
Well,
and I'm a big believer in pumping the protein for athletes. I really, truly am. All these admonishments about it being bad for your kidneys and your liver is just nonsense, absolute nonsense. As you can imagine, I've literally had thousands of clients. Over the last 36 years, I've been working professionally in this field, and everyone that I put on a high-protein, low-carb, moderate to high-fat diet gets stellar results, stellar, stunning, like night and day. I've never had a person yet that didn't get great results. I've offered people their money back, and I've never had anyone take me up on it.
Huh.
No one. And, I mean, we're talking about years and years and years. And there have been people that told me they just couldn't do it. There's people that dropped out and wouldn't do it, because of emotional reasons.
Sure.
Their family was, traditionally, like a lot of Italian families, that, the pasta, and I've had some Asian people that had rice-based meals all their lives, and this was just something they just couldn't, wrap their minds around, But outside of those people that dropped out, I've never had anyone fail on the diet. Just never.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, and that's, again, that goes to a testament of, you know what works because you worked with enough people to know what works, not just because you think it's a good idea.
Well, it's not just stuff I'm making up, and it's not just stuff that, is like, guesswork. I mean, you're right. While I'm not a scientist, I am a scientist. My laboratory is the gym. I think guys like me and you, they're actually in the trenches working with people day in and day out. We have such a better handle on what works and what doesn't work. There's a lot of theories and there's a lot of white lab coat geeks in there with all these different theories and this and that and the other thing, but they're not in the trenches every day like you and I. They're not. They don't
makes
see
a big
the
difference.
Volume of people like we do, and you really do very quickly learn what works and what doesn't work. There's a lot of really cool ideas out there, but when they're put into practice, a lot of times they just don't pan out. They don't pan
right.
out at all. And of course, you always have to take emotional and psychological factors and put that into the equation, because when you're working with people, there's a lot of individual tolerances, a lot of belief systems, and so forth. And like we had hit on before, an awful lot of what's going on with your personal reality has to do with the way you believe.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe something
that's
enough,
so
it's true.
Right.
There's an awful lot has to do with that belief system. So you got to have faith in what you're doing. You got to believe in it, or if not, you're not going to be successful. So no matter what program or what regimen you get involved, you got to have confidence in it, and otherwise, it's just not going to be successful.
Well, see, we're winding down a little bit, but I'd be a little bit remiss if I didn't tell you it was a great thrill for me when you asked for some of my fan bags, and that was very cool because I know you with your background in the martial arts and wrestling and so forth, that you've been using sandbags for years. So I know you're also into stone lifting and some odd object lifting, and I get a big kick out of a story you told me about some pretty good strength athletes that had a hard time lifting your old stone, I think it was. Can you tell us a little bit about why you do such odd object lifting and what benefits you find from it?
Well, when you do a deadlift or, say, a power clean even, or any of the standard barbell lifts, there is a groove that you get into, and everyone finds their own groove. And if you get just a little out of the groove, a lot of times you'll fail in the lift or even hurt yourself. Well, when you're on the mat and you're trying to do a Morota Gari double leg pickup throw on a guy and throw him to his back, or you're shooting in for a double or a single, you get in every kind of weird angular position you possibly can. And you still got to muster the energy to pick your opponent up, sometimes literally physically up off the ground. And this is true even in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, where there's not as much emphasis on throws and takedown, but still, sometimes off the bottom, you'll get into a position where you try to sweep the guy, and you got to unbalance the guy, and your back isn't always in that nice little grooved out position. So learning how to lift from a variety of positions. And when you lift a sandbag, it's never the same lift twice, even if it's the same sandbag, because of the shifting nature of the bag. It's moving around almost like a live opponent. And you also learn a form of lifting called a round back lift or round back deadlifting, where you don't have that nice arched back, but your back is actually rounded. And you can learn to do it quite safely, by using proper abdominal pressurization skills and having really strong abs and so forth to stabilize the spine. and you can get really strong. And I've seen some pretty good deadlifters that were used to their nice little grooved lift attempt to pick up like an odd object, like a big round stone, or I used to have this big steel wrecking ball. It was a big, shiny steel, it looked like a marble, big old thing that about 185 pounds. It was real slick and slippery and really hard to hold on to. And plenty of guys that could deadlift over 500 pounds could not shoulder that thing. Same thing with the sandbag. I had a 200-pound sandbag I had made. This is before your fine bags. I used to have to make them out of these pretty sea bags, you know. They were pretty awkward, and sometimes the suckers would burst on me, give me a hand shower.
Been there.
Too bad you didn't have those bags back then, man. It saved me a lot of cleanup bills, man. But this is before anybody was actually making any decent bags. You just had to make the homemade things, you know, with the duct tape
mm-hmm.
on it.
Yep.
But I had a couple fairly well-known guys from the kettlebell community who were also known for their deadlifts and strength. They couldn't budge that 200-pound sandbag. And I had a little 165-pound jiu-jitsu guy, a Brazilian kid, a young black dog, who had never lifted weights in his life. And he came in and he ripped that sandbag off the floor and threw it up on his shoulder. And it just goes to show you the difference between, you know, people talk about functional strength all the time. That's pretty goddamn functional, man, you know? That's
right.
Really functional. Because, I mean, think about it. When do you ever really use a deadlift form in the way that you lift a barbell, you know? If you're flipping a tire, your palms are facing. That's a whole different lift. If you're trying to lift the end of a car out of the ditch, you know, palms facing, you don't do a mixed grip. You don't do an overhand grip like a clean. It's an underhand grip. And half the time in jiu-jitsu and wrestling, you're bent over and kind of extended out when you lever people up. So it takes a lot of knack, and you have to really know how to use your body to lift something like a sandbag. And these two guys are pretty chagrined, you know. They could not move that sandbag. And all my jiu-jitsu guys could do it. But I guarantee none of them could deadlift as much either. But it doesn't matter, because they had the real strength for what they needed. That's the key. But I would rather be able to lift a 200-pound sandbag any day than have a good deadlift if I had to make the choice. And frequently you do, because there's not enough time in the day to be good at everything. So athletes who really want real-world strength, who really want to have back strength at odd angles, and you don't always get a pick, you know, what angle you're going to be lifting from, well, then the sandbag is an absolute must. You got to have it. And I'll tell you, I took your sandbags over to Iceland with me. I took about a dozen sandbags. And I was a little concerned, you know, that I was going to have a whole bunch of sandbags to take back with me.
Right, sure.
And, you know, I was trying to minimize. I took some power wheels and some other equipment. And it was all for sale. And I went down to the beach with my friend Gujan, and we filled the sandbags up with these real fine little stones, little pebbles. They were just the mm-hmm. best fill I've ever seen, way better than sand.
Oh, yeah.
These little tiny rocks. They were beautiful, man. And we made them different weights, you know, some light, medium, heavy. And I put a group of special ops guys. These guys were all trying for this, like a SWAT team, the Icelandic equivalent of the SWAT team. Put them through a brutal sandbag workout. You know, almost every one of them was sold. The guys all went nuts
cool.
over the sandbags. They liked them more than any of the other stuff I brought. They liked the stuff better than kettlebells. They all went
wow.
nuts for them, and I sold every damn one of them except for two. I actually had to keep two of them because I still had some more demos to do around the island, so I had to hold on to a couple of them. But they went crazy for those bags because they immediately saw the value. We just did simple exercises like clean and press and lifting and shouldering to the right shoulder, lifting shouldering to the left. Bear hug squats, farmers walk holding the cloth in front of you. We did no arms get ups. It's one of my favorite exercises where you
Ooh.
Hold the bag in your chest, you do a reverse lunge back, lay down on your back, do like a little kip, come up on one leg and stand up without using your elbows or your hands on the ground. Then you have to reverse legs. Beautiful grappling exercise. But they were just simple little circuit we did, and these guys were pretty good shape boys. They were all in there gasping for all And I don't think any of those sandbags was over 100 pounds. Most of them were between 80 to 100, and these were some pretty brawny young Icelandic Vikings, and their tongues were hanging out. And every one of them saw the value of that kind of training, every single one. They said, man, this is the bomb. So,
and that's what I try to tell people. People get, you know, we're especially Americans, are fixated on weight. I try to tell people it's not the same. Don't try to replicate the barbells or even dumbbells. It's just a totally different ball game.
Well, I could take pretty much an 80, maybe 100-pound sandbag and take just about any pro athlete and put him on his knees, literally on his knees, gasping, if not puking. That's just how tough a sandbag can be if it's used properly. And it's a beautiful way to train, and especially for grapplers.
Right.
So, you know, like I said before, there's only but so much time of the day, and most athletes need to spend the majority of their time doing their training. They need to be out there in the mat practicing the skills of what they do. So they don't have time to do all these separate programs. And the sandbag, much like the kettlebell, it immediately involves the cardio system, strength, endurance. There's a lot of mobility. There's a lot of angular type of lifting to it. So that's one. There's one modality protocol that gives you a really big bang for the buck.
And
it's kind of fun to cycle off. But a lot of the workouts I do with my guys, I'll pick one really good kettlebell exercise, like a turkey setup, one really good sandbag exercise, let's say like either no hands get ups, or I love doing just repetition shouldering moves, which I think is just a phenomenal exercise. Maybe one really good body weight exercise like that, and just make a little circuit. So you one or two moves with each one, and you just go through. Great way to train, and it gives you a nice variety. You get the best of all these different modalities, and so forth. So
that's beautiful and brutal.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, see, we're winding down. I really appreciate your time because I know you're busy with a lot of different projects, and I just want to let everyone know, you know, number one, where they can find out more about your workshops, your certification programs. Where's the best place for people to go to?
Well, if they go to my website, maxwellsc.com, they can look and see where I'm going and what I'm doing. And also if they go to maxbell.com, that's the certification site, they can read all about it. And I do blogs. I always hated it, Josh, the slick internet marketing stuff where you just get bombed with emails every day.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a newsletter, but I promise my readers that I only do blogs maybe once every week to 10 days because I know what it's like to just get smashed. And I always try to give some decent information, too, not just advertising stuff. But, you know, giving a little, too. Interesting things that I'm doing, places I'm going. I go to some very strange, exotic places. I've been to Tahiti. I already mentioned I'll be in Hawaii. I'll be in Dublin, Ireland. Just very interesting, exotic places. And if people want to follow my adventures, they can sign up for that newsletter also, and I'll let them know where I'm at and when the next certification is going to be.
Well, and you have, we touched on a couple of your DVDs, but I'm just looking at the site now, and, you know, one of my favorites was your ultimate pull-up one. That's phenomenal. There's just so many great drills in there. There's I remember the Cruel and Unusual one from back in the day, and it seems like you've redone it, and that was just great. Is there a really fast, what can you recommend people start with if they're interested in getting involved in your program?
Well, some of those DVDs are a good place to start. That 300 bodyweight series is a real good one to start with. That's the real basic exercises. And on the 300 challenge, the bodyweight one, there's three different levels. There's a beginner, intermediate, and advanced level. So anybody of any condition could start with that one and, you know, build themselves up slowly. And that last little routine that at the end, you know, once you build up to that point, you consider yourself in pretty good shape.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been through that. That's a brutal workout, and I definitely have to recommend personally to the Encyclopedia of Joint Mobility just for people. I know it's a big deal. A lot of people have a lot of aches and pains, and you know, are tired of having them. I think that motivates a lot of people, and that's a great resource as well. So, well, Steve, thank you so much again. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well,
and
thanks for having me as a guest, and thanks for giving me the exposure. I really appreciate it. And
absolutely.
We'll be talking again soon sometime, all right?
All right, great, Steve. Thank you so much. That's Steve Maxwell. Again, his website is maxwellsc.com. This is Josh Hankin for SandbagFitnessSystems.com.